When one of the Pharisees invited Jesus to have dinner with him, he went to the Pharisee's house and reclined at the table. A woman in that town who lived a sinful life learned that Jesus was eating at the Pharisee's house. So she came there with an alabaster jar of perfume. As she stood behind him at his feet weeping, she began to wet his feet with her tears. Then she wiped them with her hair, kissed them, and poured perfume on them. When the Pharisee who invited him saw this, he said to himself, "If this man were a prophet, he would know who is touching him, what kind of woman she is, that she is a sinner." Jesus answered him, "Simon, I have something to tell you." "Tell me, teacher," he said. "Two people owed money to a certain money lender. One owed him 500 quid and the other 50. I don't know how to say that word. Sorry. Neither of them had the money to pay him back, so he forgave the debts of both. Now, which of them will love him more?" Simon replied, "I suppose the one who had the bigger debt forgiven." "You have judged correctly," Jesus said. Then he turned toward the woman and said to Simon, "Do you see this woman? I came into your house. You did not give me any water for my feet, or she wet my feet with her tears and wiped them with her hair. You did not give me a kiss. But this woman, from the time I entered, has not stopped kissing my feet. You did not put oil on my head, but she has poured perfume on my feet. Therefore, I tell you, her many sins have been forgiven, as her great love has shown. But whoever has been forgiven little loves little." Then Jesus said to her, "Your sins are forgiven." There the guests began to say among themselves, "Who is this who even forgives sins?" Jesus said to the woman, "Your faith has saved you. Go in peace."
Hasn't he got a lovely voice? It's great. And I'm so grateful for your prayers for my voice. And yeah, very frustrating not being able to talk, but finally I can. And eventually you get sick of it. We're going to come on to this passage in just a moment. We're just reflecting on when you go to a shop, the amount of consumer choice we have these days is incredible. Like, you know, you have just one item, but there are many, many different versions of pretty much the same thing. And you're probably aware, like, with most items, there seems to be, like, the real deal, like the original kind of product, and then there seems to be like a supermarket own brand version of that same product. Everyone aware of that? Okay. So quick show of hands. Who here would say that they are you're a kind of buy the original kind of person? So, you know, if you're shopping, you'll go for like the original Coca-Cola or the original Kit Kat, or hands up if you're kind of that kind of person. Great. You like quality. That's brilliant. And then hands up if you're the kind of person who you're just all about the price. You know, even if it tastes of garbage, you just taste still. Yeah, a few of you. Okay. So yeah, it's great. But I'm a whatever's cheapest kind of person myself as well. I thought we'd just have a little test this morning to with a couple of products to work see if actually there is any difference between them. So I need somebody to come and test. First of all, different types of chocolate digestive, and then Coca-Cola as well. Is anybody willing to do that for me this morning? Just going to wait. Oh, Steve, that's amazing. Great. Round of applause for Steve. Here we go. Okay, so there are two types of... Don't look at the bottom because it's very... Yeah, it will say the name on it. So there we go. You took quite a big chunk there, didn't you? It's going to take you a while. Okay, and then the other one. And so you have to tell me which one you think is the McVitie's chocolate digestive and which one you think is the Co-op own brand milk chocolate digestive. Let's reveal. You're right. Yeah. Very good. Okay, now Coke. That was a surprise because this morning at Parkway, they said the other one. So anyway, yeah. No. Okay, so if you want to try that one, so one of these is real full-fat Coca-Cola, and then the other one isn't. They're both flat because I was on my bike this morning. They are both flat, aren't they? They're both horrible. No idea. Really? Yes. Yeah, you're right. Yeah. Thank you so much, Steve. That is horrible, isn't it? Yeah. That's horrible as well. Yeah, they are both horrible. So anyway, so you have, with many different things, you have like the real deal, like the original quality, and then you have kind of supermarket products as well. And with most of them, you can't tell the difference, but I think with Coke, you particularly can. Now, I use it as an illustration to begin with because we're going through, have been going through the book of Luke and asking the question, what does this mean for us in the 21st century as we seek to try and follow Jesus? And we come to this story today where Luke purposely contrasts the faith of two different people. He tells a story. Luke tells us a story, and here we have these two people. And Jesus wants what Luke's trying to get us to do is to work out which one has like the real deal faith that's sincere and authentic and meaningful, and who has the shallow, meaningless faith. That's the contrast he's setting up for us in this passage. And Luke often does this. You go through the gospel, that's the kind of style of writing. He contrasts a tax collector with a Pharisee, or he contrasts two brothers to see the different reaction. The real reason he's doing this is because he wants us to see ourselves in the story so that we can think, oh yeah, what would I have done? Or what kind of faith do I have? The thing is with this passage is it's not what you think it's going to be. When I hear that phrase, like real deal faith, I immediately feel quite guilty because I think of that as someone who is full of certainty, has like an incredible prayer life, is very moral and all these other things. And, you know, that's not me on the best of days. And yet, what we see in this story, which is the punchline we're going to come on to, is the person who has the real deal faith is actually a great surprise. It's not what you're going to expect. So let's look at the story. Let's jump on in. What's happening here is there's a party going on, big feast, celebration, and there's three main players here at the party. Number one, you have Jesus. He's been invited to the party. We're not quite sure why. It could be in order to test him, in order to kind of ridicule him in some way, as the Pharisees kind of like to do in those days we read in other gospel passages. It could be because they were genuinely interested. It's the Messiah, the chosen one. And so they're trying to work out for themselves. And so they've invited him for dinner. So there you have Jesus. Then you have this guy called Simon, who's the host. And we're told that he's a Pharisee, which means that he was an expert in the law of Moses. And not only an expert, but he sought to live it to the letter. Strict observance of the law of the first five books of the Bible, trying to keep it. And not only himself, but trying to get the whole nation to keep it as strictly as possible. Because they believed that if every person in Israel lived it just for one day, then the kingdom of God would come. So that was like a big deal for them. And so also alongside Simon, who's the host, you have loads of other Pharisees who would have been part of the feast as well. And there they are, and they would have been reclining kind of on their sides, around a central table. That's how they ate in those days at such celebrations. Where you have someone else's feet in your face. Doesn't sound great, does it? But anyway, that's how they did it in those days. And all is going well, you know, nice social occasion. And then what happens is the third main player enters the room and spoils the environment, really. And we're told that this is a woman. We're told that it's an unclean woman. Most likely this is, she hasn't gone through the right purity rituals that the Pharisees would have expected. We're also told that she has a morally dubious past, something about her past. Most likely from other gospels, you kind of get a bigger picture, and it's likely that she's a prostitute of some kind. But it's her faith that Luke wants us to notice. And this is the punchline of the story. It's her who Jesus praises for her faith. She's the real deal. Despite her past, despite the fact that she's a woman, which in those days they were seen as second-class citizens, always radical Jesus is the one who comes in and says, no, it's her faith. She's the one that shines out for all to see. Rather than Simon the Pharisee. And so what is it about her faith that's so genuine and real? Well, you can sum it up in one sentence. She gets grace. She gets the concept of grace, not just as some kind of intellectual understanding, but on a personal level. She understands what it means for her as well. What is grace? Grace is the unmerited favor of God. It's the understanding that I'm broken, I'm messed up in so many different ways, and I'm in need of the forgiveness of God, I'm in need of the favor of God, I'm in need of the love of God, and there's nothing I can do to kind of get that by being super intelligent or super moral or super anything. God just kind of pours it out anyway. That's his favor, it's his grace. This came up recently in the news. I don't know if you saw Glastonbury a couple of weeks ago, but it was the first rapper to ever headline Glastonbury, this guy called Stormzy. And this is one of his songs called Blinded by Your Grace. And in the chorus, he sings, Lord, I've been broken. Although I'm not worthy, you fixed me. I'm blinded by your grace. You came and saved me. Lord, I've been broken. Although I'm not worthy, you fixed me. I'm blinded by your grace. You came and saved me. And this is the attitude of the woman who comes to Jesus. She's been blinded by his grace. She realizes that everything is a gift. She realizes her kind of sense of indebtedness and her need of God's kindness and of Jesus' forgiveness and mercy. In fact, we could summarize the whole passage with this phrase here, which is a phrase I'm going to keep coming back to. Recognizing debt leads to responding devotion. It's as you recognize your sense of indebtedness to God, somehow that leads to responding in some kind of devotion. And they're the kind of 2 points that I want to pick up on that I really think have something to say to us today as we see ourselves and we look at those around us. So what does the woman do in this kind of social setting? Well, it says here, then she knelt behind him at his feet. Remember, they're all lying down and they're at his feet, weeping. Her tears fell on his feet and she wiped them off with her hair. Then she kept kissing his feet and putting perfume on them. She'd heard that Jesus was a friend of sinners, someone who showed compassion to the least likely of people, those on the outside. And so she wanted to come and show some gratitude, began anointing him with this perfume. But as she anoints him, like the tears just begin to flow. And I don't know if you've ever been in that kind of situation where you cry and you don't want to cry. And then it's like, what do? You need a tissue, but there's no tissue. And so in that situation, she grabs her hair and then begins kind of wiping his feet in this kind of mess that's going on. She wouldn't know the full extent of how he would pay for her debt on the cross, but in that moment, she senses the forgiveness of God through Christ. What's the reaction? Well, we're told when the Pharisee who had invited him saw this, that's Simon, he said to himself, if this man were a prophet, this is Jesus, if he like was the Messiah, if he was the real deal, he would know what kind of woman is touching him. She's a sinner. It's very judgmental, isn't it? And so Jesus, who just loves to challenge things, you know, doesn't let anything go by without, right, okay, here we go. And he never does it directly. He never says, Simon, what are you talking about? What he does is he tells a story. This is brilliant. And the story he tells is the equivalent of, in our day, the kind of story about two bookies who are up to their heads in debt to a loan shark named Vito. It's that kind of story. Think Godfather here. And so we have these two people who owe differing amounts of money, but neither of them can pay it back. None of them can do anything about their debt, Jesus says in this story. They both face the same fate. That's what they have in common. But here's the difference. One debt looked manageable. One debt wasn't massive, massive, massive. He couldn't pay it, but it just wasn't huge. Whereas the other guy knew that he was in trouble. He was desperate. It says verse 42, when they could not pay, neither of them could pay, And both of them could expect to lose everything they had and at best go to prison for it. And at their darkest moment, Jesus says, Vito the loan shark calls them both into his office and says, I'm going to make you an offer you can't refuse. And then he wipes out both debts. Gone. And then Jesus turns to Simon and he says, there's the story. Now, which of those do you think is going to have their world turned right upside down? Which of those two is going to be filled with relief and gratitude and joy and love for the person who has got rid of this debt? The little debt guy or the big debt guy? Now, the answer is both. Both should be incredibly grateful for what this person has done. Well, the point he's trying to make is this: recognizing debt leads to responding devotion. When we recognize how indebted we are, how broken, how messed up, how in need of forgiveness we are, it will lead somehow to some responding devotion. And that's what's going on with the woman here. Contrast that with Simon the Pharisee, who is there, he's ready to condemn. Don't you realize she's a sinner? Condemn, condemn, condemn. Why is that his attitude? Well, because he doesn't see himself as indebted. He doesn't see himself as a sinner. He sees her. He doesn't see the plank in his own eye. And so that raises the question, do we see ourselves as indebted in some way? I think most of us are aware of our failings, our flaws, the ways that we mess up. I think many people in this culture would be aware of some kind of moral standard or a sense of right and wrong that is beyond any one person and beyond any culture as well. Cultures might change, but there is something beyond that. There is a definite right and wrong. And I think most people would say that they fall short of that standard. For Christians, this feeling has been associated with not just having failed some kind of impersonal law out there, but having failed a personal God. It's a personal standing, a personal feeling of indebtedness to God. And that's not to make us feel rubbish about ourselves, but more about just simply embracing reality. That's like the way it is. We mess up, we fail one another. This is about embracing humility, about embracing ourselves, and then ultimately embracing God as well. Other people kind of recognize this sense of indebtedness or having fallen short. There's a brilliant philosopher called Alain de Botton, who his starting point is atheism. He says, I don't believe in God, but I don't want to kind of throw away all religion. And so I want to kind of glean the good things about different religions that, you know, are good. Pick a mix, whatever. But one of the things he picks up on is the Christian notion of original sin. This idea that we're kind of fundamentally broken and flawed. He said this in an interview: I love the concept of original sin. The idea that we're all fundamentally broken and fundamentally incomplete. The interviewer asked him, why do you love that idea? And this is what he said. He says, because it seems to me that it's such a useful starting point. You know, if you imagine a relationship in which two people think they're great, you know, perfect, that's going to lead to intolerance and terrible disappointment when they realize they're not that great. They're not perfect. Whereas imagine a relationship that begins under the idea that two people are quite broken and therefore they need forgiveness from the other and they need to apply charity to the other and they need to forgive the other. And so that seems a much better starting point. I like these descriptions of human beings as being really quite flawed and crazy and out of control that you find in Buddhism and Judaism and Christianity. The human being is presented as a very fragile, sort of broken creature. And I like that. It's a good starting point and also feels true to my experience. How indebted, how aware of your flaws are you? For this woman, she's so aware. She's just broken, broken by shame and guilt and all the rest. But that leads to a question. How does Jesus know that? How does Jesus know that she feels indebted to God or indebted in some way and Simon the Pharisee doesn't? Isn't that a bit judgmental of him just kind of making that quick judgment? And didn't he say a few verses before, do not judge? Well, yeah, what's going on here? Well, Jesus knows because he sees the actions of both of them. It's our actions that give away our our attitudes, isn't it? And that's what Jesus sees in each of these two characters in the story. Now, to understand the next bit of the passage, the final bit, we need to understand something about hospitality. And so what I want to ask you right now is, when you have people over for dinner, just think about, you know, a couple come over for dinner and you're gonna cook food or whatever for them. What are the things that you would do automatically to make them feel welcomed, or, you know, to show good hospitality to them? What would you do? So they arrive at your door. What do you do? Go on, shout out some things. Make them a cup of tea. Yeah, offer them a drink. Yeah, can I get you a drink? Yeah, that's a good like start. Probably open the door first. That would might help. How are you? How are things? Yeah, a bit of small talk. Don't just jump in there with the deep and heavy. Yeah. Any food dislikes beforehand? Oh, very good, Mr. Murphy. Yeah. Any allergies? It's normally that point that I'm like, oh no, they're vegetarian. Anything else? What other things would you do? Take the coat? Yes. What's the other one? Appetizers, yeah. A few nibbles on the side. That's always a good touch, isn't it? No one wants to wait for their dinner. Likes to have a few crisps to go. Yeah, anything else? When you go to actually eat, what do you do then? Offer them a seat, yeah. Anything else? Serve them first, rather than like just tuck into your dinner like, and then get them later. So can you see there's all kinds of like unspoken things, but if you weren't to do them, it would be considered rude, right? It's just good hospitality. It's social etiquette. Is there anything from anyone here from other cultures where you do particular things that we don't do in Britain in terms of showing welcome? Yeah, what do you do? Offer them cold water. And that's a way of saying, yeah, welcome. Yeah, that's great. Brilliant. Yeah, what do you do, Emma? You break a colon. Colonat. Oh, cola. Yeah. Okay. And you break one. Love that. That is great. Awesome. Did everyone hear that? The stuff that comes from colonat, they break that as a way of saying welcome. Yes. Would you give a what? A cuddle, a hug. Not like a proper cuddle. Come here. Love it. That's great. So can you see there's like different things that you do? And to do it, why do we do these things? What are we trying to say to the person who has come over? What are we trying to make them feel? Welcomed. Yeah, what else? Important. What else? Accepted. Yeah. Friendship. Yeah. Any other words? Valued. At ease, comfortable, honoured, respected, all these things. Okay, right, you've got that. Okay, so in the Middle Eastern culture, the way that you would show all of those things would be you do three things. One would be you would wash their feet as soon as they arrived, because stinking feet in your face, no one's wanting that. So the servants would come in, wash the feet. That's one thing, one way of saying you are so welcomed here. Thank you for coming. The next thing, you kiss them on the cheek as a way of welcoming. And the third thing is you anoint their head with oil. All of these ways are ways of saying, you are so valued, you are so respected, thank you for coming, we honour you as our guest. Now check out the next bit, verse 44. Then he turned towards the woman and said to Simon, just picture that for a moment. He's not talking to Simon, even though he is talking to Simon. He's looking at the woman as he says these words. Do you see this woman? I came into your house. You did not give me any water for my feet, but she washes my feet with her tears and wiped them with her hair. You did not give me a kiss, but this woman, from the time I entered, has not stopped kissing my feet. You did not put oil on my head, but she has poured perfume on my feet. Therefore, I tell you, her many sins have been forgiven, as her great love has shown. But whoever has been forgiven little loves little. Then Jesus said to her, your sins are forgiven. You see, her faith affects her actions. Her indebtedness leads to responding devotion. Whereas Simon has shown a complete lack of disrespect, a complete lack of respect, you know, has shown no honor to Jesus at all, no hospitality. And so going back to the story, big debt guy, little debt guy, who represents who between the woman and Simon the Pharisee? Simon would have thought, the woman, she's the one with the big debt. But actually, there is a greater sin defining the room. It's the sin of lips that won't kiss, of knees that won't kneel, of eyes that will not weep, of hands that will not serve. It's the sin of a heart that will not break, a life that will not change, and a soul that is too stubborn and proud to love. Recognizing debt leads to responding devotion, which leads to the kind of final challenge for us. How does our sense of indebtedness to God change the way that we treat other people? How do we find some expression for this love that we have for God? I was on a train recently, and it was one of those trains that was really crowded, you know, the type, just horrible, isn't it? Like, there's kind of no room to maneuver at all. And there I was, and I had this big rucksack on, and there was a couple right in front of me who they clearly got together quite recently, and I could tell because they were showing affection publicly. It's something you just don't do after a few years of marriage, certainly not on a train. And but there they were, and I was standing there, and they started. It started off with kind of whispering sweet nothings in each other's ears, and then it eventually got to the point where they were full-blown kissing. And there I was, and the problem was because I had this bag on, I couldn't move. So, and they were just right in front of me. So I just had to watch. So there they were, and here I was. And if you think that was uncomfortable, what happened next was even more uncomfortable. They started sniffing each other. I didn't even know that was a thing, but they were sniffing each other, and I couldn't move. And there I was. And part of me was tempted to get quite angry, like, you know, who do they think they are? Don't they realise there's other people on the train? And then I thought to myself, oh, come on, you're only young once. And when you're in love, yeah, they knew other people were on the train, but when you're in love, you don't notice, do you? When you're in love, you want to express that love. You want to show that love in some kind of way. Obviously, like, over time, as your love matures, you find other ways of showing that affection, like a cup of tea in bed, you know, which is pretty much as good, isn't it? Or my grandparents, they cut each other's toenails. They do. Yeah, it's lovely. I know. They can't bend anymore, so they just got to... It's true. It's true. But the point is this, love must find expression. You know, when you love, you got to find ways of showing it. And part of that might feel natural. At other times, it might not feel so natural. But because of your commitment, you just do it because you love this responding devotion. And that's what the woman is doing here. And the woman can do something in some ways that we can't. You know, there was Jesus. She could literally honor him, show hospitality to him, show devotion, show love in that moment. We can't do that. In the same way. But in Matthew 25, Jesus says that whenever we do it to others, to the least of these, then we're in some sense doing it for Jesus. And so whenever we show hospitality to someone, particularly the poor or those not honored, then we're doing it to Jesus in the same way that this woman is honoring Jesus in this moment. And so I want to go back to those words that we picked up on earlier. If you go to the next slide, last slide. There's some of the words that we use to describe hospitality. Sometimes we think of hospitality in too narrow a sense. We think of it's, well, that's when you have people over for dinner. That's hospitality. And that is, that's a wonderful way of showing hospitality. But I think it's broader than that. It's about everyday ways of doing these things. So whenever we show welcome, whenever we respect others, whenever we... are honouring others, we're showing hospitality to them in some sense. And so I want you to think through tomorrow when you go to your job or your clubs or whatever you're up to tomorrow, how can you honour and show hospitality to others, particularly the least of these, and by doing so, you're being like the woman who's showing it to Jesus, who wasn't honoured in that situation. I came up with a few scenarios. The plumber who comes over tomorrow to service your boiler. What will you do to make them feel totally at home, to show them honor for the way that they are serving you, even if you're paying them to be there. The person serving you at Aldi or Waitrose or wherever, in the most non-weird way, how will you take interest and honor the person who is serving you? Because often they're just forgotten, aren't they? Not even human. Just want to get my thing done. How will you honor them? The person who turns up for a job interview looking nervous, how will you make them feel comfortable and settled? The new person who turns up to your tennis coaching session or your drama club or whatever, how will you make them feel welcome? Because walking into a new room isn't always nice, but how will you, because they're the person of least honor in the room because no one knows them, how will you be like the woman to Jesus? And then finally, the people at the bottom of the ladder of society that others won't honor, how will you honor them? When you walk into a room and you see, think about who is the person of least honor in this room. How will you make them feel so welcomed in that moment? Because as we do that, we honor Jesus as well. Recognizing debts leads to responding devotion. And this isn't just about being nice people, although I'm sure it will make us a bit nicer. This is about being blinded by God's grace. This is about responding to our sense of indebtedness. We're indebted to God in some way, and now we respond. Now we go and honor and welcome and show hospitality to others. So let's pray, shall we?